This is the Crisis Point. My friends, welcome to the Crisis Point podcast, where, like G.K. Chesterton, we discuss nothing except for politics and religion because, well, there's nothing else to discuss. I am your host, Michael Warren Davis, the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine, and I'm really grateful to you all for being here. So we have a lot to discuss this week. A lot has happened since we last spoke. Just as I was driving into the office, there was the Supreme Court ruled on another landmark case. We're going to discuss that. We're going to discuss Bishop Robert Barron's unusual open letter concerning the role of the clergy and particularly the bishops in the public square. We're going to discuss that. But first, I want to give you a little update on a story that we've been following closely. Many of you who have been reading Crisis and have listened to this podcast will remember the name Father Daniel Patrick Maloney. Father Maloney was, until recently, the Catholic chaplain at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He was asked to resign, quote-unquote, by the Archdiocese of Boston after he sent out a letter about the death of George Floyd in police custody. And if you want more information about that, check out my author page on Crisis Magazine. Listen to last week's podcast. There's a lot there. We've been digging really deep into this, and apparently it's made a certain amount of impact because a few of you have written to the Archdiocese to contest their treatment of Father Maloney, which is just outstanding. And a lot of you have been asking what we can do to help Father Maloney. And, I mean, the best thing that you can do is just what you guys did. Write letters, short, respectful letters. Snail mail works best. To the Archdiocese of Boston, to Cardinal O'Malley, the Archbishop of Boston, and just say, hey, I think Father Maloney got a bum rap. I think he deserves to be back where he was. And again, a lot of you did that, and some of you got replies. And these replies are very, very interesting. So let me, this is, they're all the ones that were forwarded back to me, and again, I really appreciate everyone who forwarded these letters to me. The ones that those who received reply from Father Eric Caton, who was the director of university ministry in the Archdiocese of Boston. So this is the meat of the email. Everyone that sent it to me has they've been basically form emails, but I want to read you the really meaty part. So this is right in the middle. Father Caton writes, "It is clear that since Father Maloney's email communication on Sunday, June 7th, there have been many diverse opinions regarding the substance of his message and his subsequent resignation. Father Maloney enjoyed his time as chaplain," Father Caton continues, "and he was effective in ministering to the Catholic community. That said, the statements he made in the Sunday email, while not intentional, were nonetheless hurtful to many people. Furthermore, they were not consistent with the Cardinal's recent statement, nor the position of the Archdiocese. We heard from a number of people associated with the MIT Catholic community, alumni, and others who were very upset by his comments." Here we go. "The appointment, while provided for by the Archdiocese, is at the discretion of the university. We enjoy a collaborative relationship with the university, and we look forward to the appointment of a new chaplain in the not-too-distant future." Folks, this should be a Boston-baked bombshell. This is the Archdiocese of Boston, and not a small-level functionary who could have fudged the details. This is a rather senior member of the Archdiocesan bureaucracy admitting that that Father Maloney was asked to resign effectively at the behest of MIT. What the thrust of this email is that, you know, it's at the discretion of the university. Maybe MIT was threatening to pull the chaplaincy altogether, was going to say, either he goes or you all go. There will be no Catholic presence at MIT. I'm going to post the entire email on the Crisis website, on the podcast section, and I'll post it anywhere I can because this email needs to get around. People need to see this because, again, this is effectively the Archdiocese admitting that the principal impetus behind Father Maloney's asking Father Maloney to resign was the fact that MIT got involved. And again, they say, students, alumni, and others who are upset. It's like, just random people that wrote to the Archdiocese and said, I don't think Father Maloney should have a job because he trespassed against the orthodoxies of Black Lives Matter. I wrote to Father Caden, and I wrote to Terry Donnellan, the spokesman for the Archdiocese of Boston, and I asked them to comment on this. This was 2 weeks ago. I asked them to comment on this email. I said, it said that Father Maloney's statements were quote-unquote hurtful. What constitutes hurtfulness? Because clearly Father Maloney did not violate faith or morals. He did not give public scandal in any strict or meaningful sense of the term. He was removed theoretically because he was hurtful. What is the definition of hurtful that the Archdiocese of Boston is using? Do they provide priests with criteria to understand what constitutes a hurtful statement so that they don't end up being sacked for this? Or was this kind of just an arbitrary ad hoc thing that they decided to do? Or was that just a smokescreen? Is it not really about the fact that his statements were quote-unquote hurtful? Is it the fact that the Archdiocese didn't want to lose their collaborative relationship, as they say, with MIT, and so they shuffled Father Maloney out, and now they're going to shuffle in a new chaplain who's not going to make waves? Now look, guys, I understand that this is a really tight spot for the Archdiocese, because they obviously don't want to, you know, they don't want to leave all of MIT's Catholic students without any sort of spiritual direction. I get it. But honestly, if you ask me, I would have nailed it to MIT. If I was the Archdiocese of Boston, if I was Cardinal O'Malley or Father Caden, I would have said, "Dear President of MIT, the Catholic faith is going to remain unchanged, whether you like it or not. And the fact of the matter is that our priest, Father Daniel Maloney, did not violate faith or morals. He may have trespassed against the tenets of political correctness. That's altogether true. But a lot of the Catholic faith does. If we bow now to your request to silence one of our priests on your campus because he said something that makes you uncomfortable, then that means that we are effectively not going to be able to witness any of the traditional moral teachings of the Catholic faith. We're not going to be able to talk about homosexuality. We're not going to be able to talk about contraception or premarital sex. We're not going to be able to talk about transgenderism, let alone radical gender ideology. So no, if you feel the need to eject our Catholic chaplain and our Catholic chaplaincy, then we will make it very, very clear that this venerable institution in the middle of the city of Boston, at the heart of America's Catholic population, is now completely verboten as far as potential Catholic students and Catholic families are concerned. We will actively discourage our faithful, and we will ask our brother bishops to also discourage their faithful from sending their students, their children, to an institution that has attempted to silence and control and censor the Catholic chaplaincy. It is an honor to not do business with you, sir. Yours sincerely, Cardinal Sean O'Malley." Of course it won't happen, but here's the thing. There are so many good Catholic schools out there, Catholic universities, and not just the really big names like CUA, although those are terrific. There's Thomas More College up here in New Hampshire. There's Ave Maria in Florida. There's University of Dallas in Texas. There are so many good schools that you can send your kids to. Why would you send them to somewhere like MIT? Because you know how it is. Whether or not there's a Catholic chaplaincy there, the kid goes in for orientation week. In the first week that he's there at MIT or any of these big name schools, he or she hooks up with someone, you know, gets a drunk, does drugs, has premarital sex, and then it's over. It's pretty much over. He's not going to get up and go to Mass on Sunday. Some of them might. Maybe 10% in the first year, 5% the second, 2.5% the next, and then maybe 1.25% their final year. And by then, you know, you're rolling the dice. And unless you get snake eyes, your kid's probably going to leave the faith. This is just the way it is. Any parent who has sent their kids to a mainstream university in the last 10, 20, maybe even 60 years knows that this is exactly what happens. Why are we kidding? Why are we kidding about it? Now, this obviously isn't a detract from Father Maloney's case, and it's wonderful, it's terrific that we do have good, strong university chaplains like Father Maloney or Father Eddie Dwyer up in Michigan. We definitely, absolutely need those people, not only to hold on to the Catholics who go to those institutions, but to evangelize the young people that are there. That's just my spiel. This is kind of one of my pet peeves. This is what happens. And, you know, these are good, solid people. And they complain and they complain and they complain about how universities are left-wing breeding grounds. And then they brag to all their friends, oh, my daughter got into Harvard. My son got into Princeton. Don't do it. Look, your bragging rights aren't important. They don't matter. And it's not like they're getting any kind of decent education. Send them to a good Catholic school. And this is the thing. If the Archdiocese of Boston and other dioceses were half as concerned with supporting these good, solid local institutions, these good Catholic schools, as they were with protecting the politically correct sensibilities of the big-name schools that teach sex, drugs, and gangster rap, the world would be a much better place. We would have so many more faithful Catholics. That's my question to these bishops, and to Cardinal O'Malley in particular. What are you going to stand up for? If you're not going to stand up against MIT, if you're not going to do anything for these small faithful Catholic institutions, what are you going to stand up for? Where are your efforts going? Where are your good priests going to go? Where are you going to make your stand for the next generation of Catholics? Father Caden says that he looks forward to appointing a new chaplain in the not-too-distant future to MIT. I want to know where Father Maloney's going. Are you telling me that there are no Catholic institutions in New England, no solid Catholic schools in New England that where he can go? By all accounts, Father Maloney is not only a wonderful pastor, he's also a brilliant philosophy teacher. Is there nowhere he can go? Because it sounds to me, frankly, if he's been this shackled by MIT, it sounds like his talents were wasted there to begin with. I'm going to urge you all to keep writing to the Archdiocese. And, I mean, don't take this for an answer. Don't take this, you know, don't worry, we'll appoint a new chaplain to MIT soon. To ask him, what are you going to stand up for? Where are you going to make your stand? And what are you going to do with Father Maloney? Where is he going next? We want updates. We want to know. So please, again, be respectful. That's the number one thing. You have no idea how effective a campaign like this can be if you approach the bishops with firmness and courage, but also with reverence and respect. And we should respect them. They're our fathers in the faith. And again, pro tips, keep it short and use snail mail. Don't send emails. Emails, sometimes you get a reply. Sometimes, as these readers did. You're also more likely to get a reply from a diocesan bureaucrat. If you want to get your letter to the cardinal, to the guy in charge, snail mail is your best bet. All right, let's move on. Also, just hours before I started recording, the Supreme Court handed down two decisions and two really big cases, one of them to do with contraception. And in the interest of saving time, I'm going to have to skip over that. The thrust of it is that we won, but I'm more interested, just because there's more to say, in two consolidated cases that received a single ruling: Our Lady of Guadalupe School versus Morrissey Beru, and St. James Catholic School versus Beale. Obviously, two Catholic institutions of education, lower education, not higher education, and this concerns something that has been really, really dogging the Catholic conscience for a couple of months now, especially, which is, are Catholic schools obligated to hire or to maintain in employment people whose private lives or even whose public morality fundamentally contradicts the standards of the Catholic Church? And the decision, according to the Supreme Court, as of July 8th, is no. And the decision hinges on what's called a ministerial exception, which says that anything to do with the sort of the people who inculcate the laity in the faith cannot claim protections under most what we now call human rights, anti-discrimination legislation, which mostly just has to do with, you know, feminist, LGBT, trans nonsense. Interestingly, the ministerial exemption is now applied to teachers at Catholic institutions because, as the defense argued, Catholic teachers are by definition catechists. They are by definition people who teach the faith, regardless of the subject that they teach in. They work for a Catholic institution, therefore they are Catholic teachers, not just teachers who happen to be Catholic. And because, as this ruling found, Catholic schools are often the, quote, primary agents by which the faith is taught to children, they have a special obligation, not only to the parents, but to the children themselves as free citizens, to deliver the kind of education that they come to these institutions to receive. So let me just quote from Justice Samuel Alito's majority decision. The religious education and formation of students is the very reason for the existence of most private religious schools, and therefore the selection and supervision of the teachers upon whom the schools rely to do this work lie at the core of their mission. Judicial review of the way in which religious schools discharge those responsibilities would undermine the independence of religious institutions in the way that the First Amendment does not tolerate. That is extraordinarily strong language that is going to set an extraordinarily strong precedent in the way that private religious institutions are governed going forward. And not only the Catholic Church or the, you know, whatever, the Southern Baptist Convention, but schools, religious schools, which are finally being recognized as deserving First Amendment protections, which they have not for a very long time. For a very long time. This has been an open debate whether or not just because an institution calls itself Catholic or Christian or Jewish or whatever, it is necessarily the kind of religious institution that falls under First Amendment rights. As if the Founding Fathers' idea of religion was just this thing that you do in a particular designated, you know, tax-exempt building once a week on Sunday, or maybe at every weekday at 8 a.m. if you're a real weirdo. But otherwise, religion is basically purged from the public square. That is obviously not what the Founding Fathers envisioned, and that is obviously not what 7 out of 9 Supreme Court justices thought when they voted for this majority opinion. And let's be very clear for those two outliers, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor. Catholic schools are religious institutions. Catholic businesses are religious institutions. But you know what? Let's go even further, because religion is not just something that institutions do. Religion is something that people do. And our First Amendment rights should extend to every sphere of life, public or private. As my co-host Phil Lawler, who's on vacation this week, as he pointed out on the last show, just because you're not a religious institution doesn't mean your First Amendment rights go away. Just because you don't legally designate yourself as a religious institution, does that mean that you don't have the right to have your business ethics guided by your private faith? But anyway, let's not get too bogged down in that. That's a fight for another day. Let's just say for now that this was a real tangible victory for First Amendment rights, specifically in the context of Catholic schools. This was not just liberals giving a green light to some dissident Jesuit institution. This is a victory for the most politically incorrect orthodox idea of Catholicism, because as I said in a recent article on the Bostock versus Clayton County decision, what's to say that, let's call him Mr. John Smith, teaches at a Catholic school, what's to say that he can't show up to work one day in a dress and announce that he is henceforth to be known as Mrs. Jean Smith? Or better yet, that Jean is marrying her boyfriend, Mark Brown, and is to henceforth be known as Mrs. Jean Brown. I'll tell you what, this ruling, This ruling gives Catholic schools the explicit right to hire and fire based on the fundamental moral truths that undergird the Catholic way of life. And Catholic school teachers must be not only faithful in their teaching, but faithful in their public life and in the example that they set for their students. And that is a really, really terrific, terrific thing. And very surprising, I must say, because you'll remember it was Justice Neil Gorsuch who wrote the majority opinion on that horrible case, Bostock versus Clayton County, that brought gay, trans, LGBT rights under the greater mantle of human rights under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So he was like the main villain of that decision, and now he's one of the heroes. And a decision that was, you know, decided by a far larger majority. So this is real, true reason to be hopeful that we haven't, despite some recent setbacks and some really, really rotten rulings, especially by men that we thought were our friends, John Roberts, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, the fight is definitely not lost. The fight is never lost. As T.S. Eliot said, there's no such thing as a lost cause because there's no such thing as a gained cause. But we needed this moral boost. This was a good week for the Supreme Court. After a couple of really bad weeks, a couple of really bad months, this was a good week. We're going to wrap it up in a minute, but I just wanted to touch on one more thing. It's a letter, an open letter, written by Bishop Robert Barron called "Why? What Are the Bishops Going to Do About It? Is the Wrong Question." This was published on his Word on Fire blog, his very popular catechetical thing, and it got absolutely panned. It got panned by Michael Voris and Taylor Marshall and a bunch of others, just about every luminary of conservative traditionalist Catholicism had a go at Bishop Barron for this, including Crisis. We published a very critical essay about it by August Mayrad, which you have to read. It got shared on Rod Dreher's blog. That was pretty cool. So that really this really resonated with people, because the thrust of Bishop Barron's article is that Vatican II, and in particular the document Lumen Gentium, but let's roll it back. The question of what are the bishops going to do about it, it being the mob of hoodlums and left-wing militants who were destroying statues of American heroes like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, but most recently, St. Junipero Serra. And Bishop Robert Barron, you might forget, is actually an auxiliary bishop in the Diocese of Los Angeles. And the Diocese of Los Angeles, well, the California Catholic Bishops Conference's collective response to this this horrible act of sacrilege, this destruction of statues of a great Catholic saint, was some very, very weak open letter saying, you know, basically saying, if St. Junipero Serra wasn't a bad guy, we might be with you, but he was actually a nice guy, and he fought for the dignity of the native peoples of the west coast of America, which is absolutely true, and he did not, you know, he was very critical of Spanish policies like enslaving the natives and things like that, and again, totally 100% true, but again, it was not a religious response. It was basically, if he had been a social worker, like a really old social worker with slightly unwoke views, the response would have been effectively the same. The only bishop who stood out was Archbishop Cordiglione of San Francisco, who is an absolute hero, and who went to the site of one of the statues that was destroyed in his archdiocese and actually said prayers of exorcism because of the horrible act of sacrilege that was committed there. Bishop Robert Barron, on the other hand, and I don't want to drag Bishop Barron, my confessor, fraternity priest, says that, especially in my line of work, anytime I say something critical about a bishop, I should go out of my way to say something nice about a bishop. And I take that seriously, and I try to do it. So let me say, Bishop, I I think Bishop Barron provides an excellent service to help Catholics educate themselves about the faith. And he had an idea a couple of months ago that Catholic Twitter should be censored by the church, the bishops, which I think is really, really great. It depends on which bishop is doing the censoring. I mean, if it's Archbishop Cordiglione, that sounds like it'd be kind of sweet. Imagine if all the Susans from the parish council had to have their tweets looked over by a priest or a bishop or something before they posted about how it's fine that their daughter got married to another woman in a Unitarian Universalist ceremony on the beach, and that the service was celebrated by a one-legged incontinent Pomeranian who invoked the great goddess Gaia, because Jesus loves everyone and there's many paths to Jesus and things like that. Imagine if they weren't allowed to post all that nonsense. That'd be awesome. So, I mean, there's potential there, for sure. But this letter was very not awesome. And the gist of it is that basically Bishop Barron says, the bishops really don't have to do very much. This is really up to the laity. And not only in protecting statues, but also in fighting the culture wars. This is more of a lay thing. And so he writes, quote, great Catholic lawyers, great Catholic politicians, great Catholic university professors, great Catholic physicians and nurses, great Catholic investors and financiers, great Catholic law enforcement officers, great Catholic writers and critics, great Catholic entertainers, each in his or her special area of competence, is meant to bring Christ to the society and the culture. And when I say Catholic here, I don't mean incidentally so, or merely privately so, but rather vibrantly and publicly so. Now, Bishop Barron cites Vatican II, and in particular Lumen Gentium, to back up this claim that it's really up to Catholic laymen to fight for the church in the public sphere. And as Taylor Marshall and others have pointed out, that's absolutely not the case. And not only is it theologically dubious, but anyone who knows anything about Catholic history knows that the idea that bishops are really only relegated to the cathedrals and priests are really just supposed to stay in the churches, and everyone will know that that's total nonsense. I mean, there's Pope St. Leo I who rode out to the walls of Rome to meet Attila the Hun and convinced him to turn back and single-handedly saved Italy. And I mean, he didn't convert Attila the Hun. That would have been awesome. But he didn't convert him to Catholicism. He went into these very careful negotiations with this barbarian, and he convinced him to turn around. Why isn't Bishop Robert Barron riding out to meet the barbarians before they sack his diocese, before they tear down statues of the saints, before they beat up soldiers and law enforcement? Why isn't it? I mean, or not necessarily Bishop Barron, but surely there's nothing wrong with him doing so. Surely it would be a great and mighty heroic thing to do. And if he, when he goes before the judgment seat, God's not going to say,
oh, Robert, it was wrong of you to leave your cathedral. Haven't you read Lumen Gentium? You should have left it to the laity.
So that's a bit of a cop-out. I mean, we all know that. That's St. Augustine. Ask St. Ambrose, or any of the medieval saints. Christopher Dawson called them popular tribunes. They were like the spokesmen for the little people. They stood up to the powers that be, and they protected the church in the public square. The king was supposed to do so, but if the king fell out of line, the bishops did not hesitate to excommunicate him. That's not saying anyone needs to be excommunicated necessarily, but I think that there's actually, I might get panned for saying this, I really think that there's something to what he said. Because, again, let's take the medieval model. Yes, the bishops are supposed to provide a stronger witness in the public sphere. No doubt about that. But so are the laity. And not only the Pope, but also the king, you know? And we complain ad nauseum about how public square is being secularized and how we're losing the culture war. But then we turn around and we expect our bishops to fight the culture wars on our behalf. And when they don't, we say to ourselves, what? Oh, well, there's nothing I can do about it. All I can do is complain and browbeat the bishops. And look, complaining to a certain extent, constructive criticism of bishops that refuse to get seriously involved in the culture wars in the public square. That's necessary. What did Archbishop Sheen say? Actually, I just looked up the quote so I can tell you. He said, "Who is going to save our church? Not our bishops, not our priests and religious. It is up to you, the people. You have the minds, the eyes, and the ears to save the church. Your mission is to see that your priests act like priests, your bishops act like bishops, and your religious act like religious." By the way, Cardinal Dolan loves to talk about how Bishop Barron is, you know, the next Fulton Sheen. Fulton Sheen wouldn't have written a letter like that. With all due respect to Bishop Barron, Fulton Sheen is known for bringing orthodoxy to the public sphere. And he, not only did he stand up against heresy, and not only did he involve himself in matters of, you know, great spiritual urgency in America in his day, he talked about communism. He talked about militant liberalism, suffocating religion in the public sphere. He very much understood these things to be in his sphere of influence. But again, we have it on Fulton Sheen's authority too. It's our job to help our priests act like priests, our bishops act like bishops, and our religious act like religious. And let's do that. But at the same time, if you're Catholic and a lawyer, or politician, professor, physician, nurse, investor, financier, law enforcement officer, writer, critic, entertainer, be a Catholic one. Be as Catholic as you can. That is your vocation. That is where you're supposed to make Christ present in society. Catholicize our politics, our culture. Whatever industry you're in, Catholicize it, Christianize it. Win it for Christ. So not to make excuses for Bishop Barron, but there is something to that. There was something to his letter. And amidst the criticism, including ours, the necessary criticism, I want to make sure that point isn't forgotten. Well, that's all the time we have for this week, and I want to thank you all again so much for joining us. Next week, I look forward to being rejoined by my co-host, Phil Lawler. In the meantime, I am Michael Warren Davis. This is the Crisis Point Podcast, and I look forward to speaking to you all again very, very soon. Thank you again, and God bless you. We'll